you are in fellowship.
And let's continue on here with the situation we're dealing with now, relating to the commandment. Again, the argument suggested that maybe there's something wrong with the law because it has such a deleterious effect on the sin nature. It does all manner of things and stirs it up, makes it lust, and all these other things. But again, it's just more of a matter of the grass is greener type mentality, and also the reality that the law itself is right, but the sin nature just can't help itself. It's just got to express itself, and it has a fundamental rebellious nature against God. And so the law is not complicit in any way. At best, the law is used by the sin nature to further its own ends. And so it, again, the sin nature, as it said, it used it as a base of operations. And it uses what is good in order to kill people. Well, that probably makes it about as evil as it can be. I mean, that I think is the definition of evil. Well, we've looked at the exegesis of verse 12, so let's move on into the exposition of it. One, Paul began verse 7 with a question regarding the relationship between the Mosaic law and the matter of sin. Are the two to be considered identical? And two, he strongly answered in the negative with his typical meganoito, may such a thing never become, but proceeded to demonstrate that while they are not to be identical, there is a fundamental relationship that exists between the law, composed of various commands from God, and the old sin nature. And three, from what Paul stated in verse 9 about the commandment coming, and what he said in verse 10 about the commandment resulting in death, one might conclude that the law was the agent that produced death. And I think in a previous point I'd said that the law was an accomplice. That's a bit of an overstatement. It's not even an accomplice. It's not as though the law has any desire or designs to be used by the sin nature. The law itself can't do anything about it. It is just a reflection of God's will. As he says here, holy, righteous, and good. So the law was used more almost as a hostage rather than an accomplice. The sin nature takes the law hostage and uses it to produce lusting of every kind, as we're going to see. So Paul has argued that the law does not initiate sin, but is involved in the exposure of sin. Now that we saw in verse 7. I would not have come to recognize, understand the old sin nature except through the law. In other words, he's not saying, I don't think he's saying he didn't know he had one. I think he's saying he didn't know how bad it was. And that's the problem. The old sin nature in some ways can seem almost benign at times. It doesn't seem as bad as it is, I don't think. But the more you grow and the more you understand this, the more sensitive you are to your failures. Well, that's good, that's healthy. But then again, that sensitivity has to be countered and tempered with the knowledge that God himself has solved all this in Christ for us. That we're not at the mercy of this anymore, this law of sin and death. For I would not have known coveting. Not known about necessarily, but known it. But the law says you can't covet, so I decided I got to covet. Well, I didn't decide. The old sin nature decided at that level. The old Ron, the old person, the old ego. Well, he's argued that it's involved in the exposure of sin, but he has consistently placed the blame for sin and its results on the indwelling old sin nature and not on the law. 7:8a, but the sin nature, establishing a base of operations through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind. He did it in 9b. The sin nature became alive, sprung into action, we might say, and I died. I was put out of fellowship. Now the sin nature is running the show. And also in verse 11, the one we just saw, the sin nature, taking an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me and killed me. Five, Paul has depicted the old sin nature as a force that lurks about, waiting for an opportunity to assert its dominance over the believer. When the believer chooses to obey it, he dies temporally, i.e. gets out of fellowship. Romans 7:9b, again, verses that we just saw. The sin nature became alive, and guess what? I died. That's it. So there he is, temporarily out of fellowship. 6, while it may remain relatively dormant and inactive, when the sin nature is confronted with the commands and prohibitions found in God's law, it reacts in defiance and rebellion against those commands and prohibitions. This is the nature of human nature, fallen human nature. Itself, it is rebellious. It doesn't have to be told to rebel. It doesn't have to be told to be bad. It is bad all by itself. And we see this from the earliest ages of children, that it doesn't take them 5 or 10 years to figure out sinning and doing wrong. They learn at the earliest age. First, they learn that they can get their way by crying. It works. They cry, well, the baby, unless the baby's an idiot and not smarter than a dog. I can make a dog salivate with repeated stimuli. Do you think the baby isn't smart enough by 6, 8, 9 months to figure out that it gets its way every time it cries? The babies are a little smarter than people give them credit for being. They're smarter than dogs, and certainly smarter than cats. But the reality is the kid figures this out pretty early on. And then by the time they're 1, 1.5, 2, you can already see the little sin nature asserting itself. Particularly as it relates, as they interact with other little children about that same age. And then it continues to get worse. Again, we never have to teach them to be bad. They know how to do this from out of the chute. And that is a perfect understanding and expression of the sin nature. That there's nothing there in their case, however, to counteract it. Well, there is. They call them parents. And the parents are supposed to deal with that little sin nature. Then, you know, you can stand around and ooh and ah. I don't care if they ooh and ah when the baby's born. Good. After that, they better get on with the job of parenting. And that means discipline. That means work. Enjoy your baby for the first week or two or three. Or four, however long you can enjoy it. And not sleeping and all that. However long you want to do that. But after that, you realize you better think as a parent, I've got to get on with the raising of this child now. And this is what most parents fail to do. They figure, I've got a kid, but it'll all work out on its own. No, it won't. Children are rebellious. They're stupid. The Bible's really plain on this. Stupidity is bound up in the heart of a child. I don't know how else you can say it. And we all were that way once, and that's a good thing, is that, of course, I've been young once. You've never been old. That's the thing with children. They've never been old yet. They've never seen and heard many of the things we've been exposed to. That are, again, only getting worse. Well, 7, Paul has sufficiently demonstrated that the law is not the old sin nature, but is used by the old sin nature to further its desires. The very presence of the law antagonizes and stimulates the sin nature to defy its precepts. And this is just, again, the inherent rebellious nature that's in all of us, that wants our way, the ego-driven life. They ought to write a book called that, Purpose-Driven Life. How about Ego-Driven Life? Because that is the human race in a nutshell. And 8, thus Paul draws a conclusion in verse 12. The inferential conjunction hosta, therefore, or for this reason, summarizes his view of the law based on the reasoning contained in the previous verses, 7 through 11. While it is not reflected, point 9 in the New American Standard, there is an untranslated particle men, which is usually coupled with the conjunction duh to establish a contrast. Well, while Paul never completes the contrast, most interpreters recognize there is an implicit contrast between the law and the old sin nature. Well, certainly there is. That we shouldn't have to figure. That's been made plain, I think, that there's an implicit contrast. He doesn't complete the contrast. He doesn't say, on the one hand, the law is holy, but on the other hand, the old sin nature is unholy. He could have said that. That would complete the contrast. But I think the contrast has been well enough implied, he doesn't have to complete it. He knows the two items here, and the reader should by now see that the two items he's dealing with are the sin nature and the law of God. These are the two predominant forces at work here. B here, however, Robertson states that the particle men was used without the conjunction duh. The original meaning is to introduce an affirmation and can be translated as surely, certainly, or truly. That comes from his book, A Grammar of Greek in Light of New Testament Research, historical research. And so, that's why here I would translate it as then. And I've been gradually working on it because now I have the ability to do this. This translation right here is mine. I've been making corrected translations as I go, we will, again, at some point, the file would be available, but you'd have to have a BibleWorks to use it, so it's probably not for you, because I think BibleWorks, the new version's got to be $400 or more by now, so... but I can also put it up here, though, and I don't know how to the extent you can read it, but, and in most cases, I don't change it much, but in this one, certainly then, is a much better, I think, translation, because it expresses more certainly what he's talking about. So see, thus, the untranslated particle is there to emphasize the incontrovertible nature of the Mosaic law. Whatever may be said subsequently cannot invalidate the fact that the law is holy. 10, the law focuses primarily on the Mosaic law, the divine revelation of God's righteous standards. The definite article and the assertions Paul makes in verse 12 demand that only the Mosaic law be in view. But again, he's never gotten far from this. I'm not sure he's ever strayed from the thought of the Mosaic law at all. Now, one can argue that in certain contexts, he uses the word law as another term for like operative principle. Well, because that's what the word law means. And he does use it that way a couple of times. But in all the other occasions, the vast majority, and I don't know how many there have been here now in Romans, but there's a lot. And the law has always been the Mosaic law, the righteous revelation of God for the human race, which was given to the Jews, but this obviously is a reflection of God's essence for everybody, to the extent that they're exposed to it. Well, his first assertion, point 11, is that the law as a whole is holy. The nominal sentence simply has the subject, an implied present tense verb, eimi, and the predicate adjective, hagios. Just a very nominal statement, just two words actually in the Greek, law, holy. Which is emphatic, and it does two things. Number one, when a word is used without the article in the Greek, and in this case the word law has the article, but it's emphasizing quality. The law has a quality of holiness about it. Hagios does not have the article. And again, it's almost a sort of Tarzan sentence. Law, holy. We know law, holy, Jane. Yeah. Well, but it's more effective, it's more forceful in some ways when you talk like that, because it really isolates on the words you're trying to focus on. The holiness of the law. Well, 12, the statement is an axiomatic one, which is a premise or assertion that is deemed so evident that it is to be accepted as true without any argument. The adjusted person is not going to argue that the law is holy. Anybody that understands God knows that if it came from him, it's got to be holy, for one thing. 13 here, the quality that Paul ascribes to the law is that of holiness. The Greek adjective hagios was originally a religious cultic concept. And by the way, when I use the word cult or cultic, unless I'm talking about, you know, I'll make it explicit, but you understand that the religious cult in the nation was, that's how they referred to it. Or they would use the word cultus sometimes. And we're not using it in a derogatory sense, like we would say today, the Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult. We're not using it in that sense, but we're just using it in the sense of the system itself, the structure of the system. This was a religious concept which denoted the quality possessed by things and people that allowed them to approach a deity. Even in the unbelieving world, when they dealt with this, you know, multiple gods, polytheism, and all that, they still had this sense that gods were above men, and that men could not approach gods apart from certain things, that they were not just simply free to willy-nilly talk to a god or deal with him or any of that, that they had better approach him, and in very, very, very often, they better have a propitiatory sacrifice with them, which is designed to appease the god. But again, when one considers the mythology and all the writings and the things that these people believed in, the Greek gods were invariably hostile to man. They hated men. They did all manner of nasty things to them just because they're gods and they could. They were capricious. They didn't have to have reasons. They would do really strange stuff. Some of them would become animals. Some of them would become human and mate with women. And of course, this is all just distortions of what comes out of the Bible as true anyway, pre-flood. But this is the way they recognized that the gods were kind of a vindictive bunch, and you really didn't want to mess with them. Actually, what you wanted to do was you just wanted the god to leave you alone, more or less, or bless you. But you didn't really want to have to deal with them all that much. You wanted to keep them happy. Now, how do you keep gods happy? Well, they had all manner of ways to do it. Well, A, it is a term that is used to translate the Hebrew noun kodesh, which denotes that which belongs to the sphere of the sacred, and which is distinct from and opposite that which is common or profane. Again, when people think of profanity or profane, they tend to think of four-letter words. And I was watching Jeopardy yesterday. They had a category called dirty four-letter words. And I thought, well, that's going to be weird. But it wasn't what you thought. It was just words like grime and muck and dirt and that kind of stuff. So, but that's what they tend to think of. Well, profane is that which is common, what's accessible to everybody. And this is why the doctrine of separation becomes an issue. Because the negative unbeliever out there, he has no restraints. He has no compunction about being around anybody. He's just an idiot. He will hang around with anybody. Doesn't matter. Now, some of them are smarter than others, and they say, oh, this heroin addict, maybe I should stay away from him. You know, he's robbed me 3 times, cheated me out of money, lied, stole my car. Okay, you can figure out maybe to stay away from him. But generally speaking, these people have no discernment. And what do I constantly hear? I'm constantly hearing on the news, it's on almost every show anymore, about embracing our differences. Let's just all get together, the whole ecumenical sort of approach to life. Let's just all drop our differences and unite under one banner. That of Satan. No, I'm not going to do that. I don't have to do that, and I'm not going to do it. But again, it gets into a fundamental view of the unbeliever and the negative believer. Their view of the world is completely skewed. It's completely wrong in most cases. They do not see it for what it is. They don't see it as the devil's world. They don't see it as a place of evil. They don't think they live in an evil age. They think they live in a massive age of new technology that's making life just glorious for all of us. Well, is it really? I mean, is it really? Do you feel a lot better being in the loop 24/7? Or sometimes you want to take your cell phone and throw it against the wall? I'd want to. I don't need to be in the loop all the time. I don't even like it. Now, I have gotten, again, a smartphone, finally, because I saw it has some advantages. But I never did want one. It's nice when you travel because you can do certain things you couldn't do otherwise. You can access the internet and find out if you're lost, where you go. Which is always good. But again, the world itself, they look at the world and they think this is a wonderful place. This is a great place filled with wonderful people who do a lot of nice things. Football players get together and then they take little boys out and show them how to play football. The baseball players will have them, a little league team in and show them how to play baseball. And just watched an old movie the other day. It was funny. It had Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris in it. And so it was about this little kid, and it was, you know, it didn't end the way I thought it was going to, though, however. This is kind of interesting, because this was from back in the 50s or 60s. I can't remember which, but probably the 60s. And this kid, well, he gets into a bind, you know, with his little buddies. And so he tells them, you know, they'd move down to Florida. This is all set in Florida, by the way. Somewhere here, I think, on the East Coast, or the West Coast, because he ends up running over to the East Coast. I can't remember quite where they were. But anyway, not that that matters. But just the boy, you know, as boys do, you know, they get into, well, I won't call it what it is, but they get into these contests about whose dad is the toughest and who knows the most and who can do this and who can do that. Little testosterone-fueled idiots. That's all they are. And I was one once, too, so I can say that. You can't accuse me of being an anti-Semite. I'm Jewish. So I was a little testosterone filled idiot too. And so, you know, you get these kind of, my dad can beat up your dad. You know. And so he gets into this deal with this kid and he says, well, my dad knows the Yankees. He knows all of them. If we move down from New York, he knows Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris. I mean, you prove it. There you go. I double dog dare you. The double dog dare. The worst of all the taunts. Movie references. So he sneaks away. Now this kid, I got to give him an A for resourcefulness. His dad's a boat captain, and he's out during the day running charters. And he gets his charter where he's got to go out for 3 days. And so the little boy sneaks off. He knows the Yankees are over in, I think at that time they were, was it Boca or somewhere over there?
Fort Lauderdale.
They're in Fort Lauderdale where they had their spring training. So he sneaks into the ballpark, manages to get in there. And if you remember I Love Lucy, Fred was one of the managers. And so he finds this little boy and he says, you know, what are you doing in here? And blah, blah, blah. And he kind of takes him under his wing. He runs him out, but then he kind of is nice to him. He's kind of a crotchety old guy. So anyway, he finally gets into the locker room. Finally, after all this convoluted stuff he does, he gets into the locker room and sees Maris and Mantle. And they're standing there. And he tells them what happened. He said, look, I made this boast about my dad knows you guys. And, you know, I said you would come over to our little league team and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and it's a real tearjerker. And you're, you know, you hope they do. And you feel sorry for the little kid. Because, I mean, I've been there. I've done that kind of stuff. And so they look at me and they say, well, son, you're a liar. You didn't know us. Your dad didn't know us. No, we're not coming over there. You need to go back and tell those people the truth. You need to stand up and be a man. You don't see that in movies today. So he goes back and he does the right thing and he stands up and he tells them, humiliates himself in front of them, tells them, and this one kid, this little his antagonist, said, well, I think he should be off the team. And his dad, who was a big money behind the team, he was the banker and all that, he said, I have respect for this. This guy came in here and took his lumps. He did what he's supposed to do. And then, of course, as it turns out, the Yankees invite the whole team over and they all get to play ball with them. Field of dreams, baby. Field of dreams. And so as I watched all that, I thought to myself, yeah, that's the way we'd like to paint the world. But that's not really what the world is. It looks, I mean, it can look good and they do nice things. They do. But why are they doing it? I mean, this whole movie, you know, you go through it and there's no mention of God ever. None of this is about Christianity or anything else. It's strictly what it is. And, you know, I like the movie. I like the premise of it. But, again, what's common, what's profane, is what's out there that anybody can access. And the negative, they don't care what they're around. They can live in a cesspool and it won't bother them. But, I know, believers don't. Or shouldn't. Both the Hebrew and Greek terms convey the idea of that which is separated to or for some purpose. That which is set apart, especially for the service of God. See, it was used to describe God's fundamental essence, which is one of separation from all that is less than Himself. That's the passage we referenced earlier, Isaiah 6, 3. This begins in verse 1, in the year of King Uzziah's death. I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of His robe filling the temple. A seraphim, a class of angels, stood above Him, each having 6 wings. With 2 He covered His face, with 2 He covered His feet, and with 2 He flew. And one called out to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of the armies. The whole earth is full of His glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of Him who called out, while the temple was filling with smoke. And then I said, woe is me, I am ruined. I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. And my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of the armies. And so, again, when people have any real experience with God, now certainly a vision like this one that Isaiah saw, you don't walk away from that unshaken. You're not that impressed with the world anymore when you've seen this. Now, we have to walk by faith. We're not under this type of revelation system now. We only get our doctrine from the Scripture itself. So we're not going to be privy to these types of things, generally speaking. I don't know anybody that ever has. But the fact is, the same holy, holy, holy Lord of the armies that Isaiah saw is still sitting on that throne. And He hasn't changed one iota. He's still far above all of it. Well, D, since the Mosaic Law came from God, even though it was delivered through Moses, those two verses just say that it was delivered through Moses, that it came through him. It must have the same character as God himself. And E, the fundamental character of the law is that of separation from sin, which is the antithesis of being sin, which was the question he'd asked earlier, is the law sin? He said, no, the law is far, far, far from sin. The law is the opposite of that. So 14, although Paul has already explained that the old sin nature has used the law for its evil purposes, that exploitation does not alter the fundamental holy character of the law. It doesn't change the law in that regard. And again, this would be tantamount to somebody being kidnapped and they cap you and get a ransom for you and all of that. And at the end of it all, if you're assuming you get saved, they pay the ransom or whatever, you haven't fundamentally changed. You're still who you were. Well, the law gets hijacked, was a better way, I think, with the old sin nature, hijacks the law to use it for its own purposes, which are evil. But it doesn't change the law. The old sin nature can use, and this is Paul's whole argument through here, the old sin nature is so incorrigible it uses that which is good to kill me. It's bad enough if it would use something bad to kill me, but it uses what's actually good to kill me. And that is, again, the bottom line of how incorrigible the thing is. So 15, in that regard, some regard the law to be holy because it commands and demands holiness or consecration from those under it. However, Paul is not focusing on what the law requires. He's focusing on the character of the law itself. And that's important, again, to keep straight all through here, that the law is fine. The law is perfect. And the sin nature is the problem. The old you. That's the trouble. That's the struggle. So 16, Paul moves on to make three assertions about the commandment. Some interpreters, Gaudet, Cranfield, and Haldane, for instance, see the term as a collective singular, used to denote all of the individual commandments within the entire law. When he says the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, righteous, and good. He could have used a plural for one thing if he wanted to. But again, given immediate context from what he's just been talking about prior to this, and that is the fact that the law itself doesn't have the problem. And what he focused on specifically back in verse 7 was the 10th commandment about coveting. Again, why? Because I think this is the most far-reaching of all the commandments. Because it says you should not have any desires that are opposed to God. Well, guess what? Everybody's got them. And so I think he's still focusing on the 10th commandment, even the very one that killed him, as it were, we might say. And he said, look, the problem's not with the commandment either. It's not with the law as a whole, nor is it with any part of the law, individualizing it. Which, you know, all the commandments, I believe the rabbi said there were 613 of them or something. They had it all figured out, of course. How many commandments do we have? How many do we obey? Well, that's a whole different deal, though, isn't it? How many do we obey? Well, 17, however, in the immediate context, the commandment more likely refers to the 10th commandment, which Paul has been using to explain the old sin nature and how it operates. And 18, even though the commandment had a deleterious, that's something that causes harm or damage, a deleterious effect in the life of Paul, he finds no fault with the commandment itself. So 19, he applies the same quality of holiness to the individual commandment that he applied to the character of the entire Mosaic law. All the law has this quality. But again, it comes from God. It has to. It can't be otherwise. Anyone that wants to posit God creating or doing something that's inherently not perfect does not understand the essence of God. He can't do that. He can't be perfect and then do that which is imperfect. He has to maintain his perfection at all times. And it's not as though God has to work at maintaining his perfection. He just is perfect. It's not like it's a hard job for him. This is the nature of his character. And so, for him, anything he does, the law, creating Satan, creating men, reformatting the world as he did after the ice pack, anything he does has to be perfect by itself. So that also leads me to believe that could that tree have had something in it that was evil? The fruit itself was evil. How did God create evil fruit? How did he do that? I don't think he did. That's why I don't buy the whole, I ate the fruit and I died and I'm going to eat fruit again and live. The fruit represents something, no doubt. But the bigger issue is obedience and disobedience, is it not? Not the nature of the fruit. And people still argue about that. What fruit was it? Who cares? It's not the fruit. There's not, you know. That's not it. He said all these trees were good to eat. But there was just one tree. He said, don't eat from that tree. And it didn't matter what the fruit was. Because the issue was the eat and don't eat. Because eating and don't eating, as we know, symbolizes faith. So what happens when we get here is what you see in Genesis 3 is that Satan exercised faith in Satan's viewpoint, and ultimately so did Adam. Adam didn't exercise faith in it, he exercised faith in Eve. Good. How'd that work out for him? Not very well. And again, this is where you have to you maintain a balance, or you try to. I want to. And that is, sometimes as a husband, you have to listen to your wife. Sometimes she's right. She's giving you good advice. Other times, if you listen to her, you're just a moron. You're just an idiot if you listen to her on certain occasions. And what a husband has to do is figure all that out. Okay, if I'm going to live with this weaker vessel, and I'm going to treat her right, and I want God to bless me and answer my prayers and all those things, then I better figure out how to do this. You see that perfectly illustrated with Sarah. In Genesis 16, she gives Abraham perfectly horrible advice and he follows it. Now, maybe seriously though, I understand that, you know, the Semitic cultures, there was a huge emphasis on being fruitful and having babies and perpetuating the family. Now, some cultures still have that. Not as much, say, in the Western cultures today, but some people still have that. And so this deal of perpetuation, and so Sarah wanted a child in the worst way possible and God just wouldn't give her one. So she comes up with an idea of how to beat God at this. Not a good idea. See, that's what Abraham should have said. Now, wait a second. And I at least like Isaac, or Jacob rather. Now, Jacob had his problems, as we know. But when Rachel came at him and said, give me children or I die. He said, am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb? You know. But I can solve your problem. Give you children or die? He didn't do that. But the fact is, and then Sarah later on, say Genesis 21, I believe it is, she gives him perfectly wonderful advice that he should follow, and he does. So as a man, again, this all you have to sort all this out. So again, Paul says, look, this is all holy. Everything's holy. The commandment's holy. The law is holy. It's all separate. It reflects God. And you just have to know that going in. 20, his second assertion is that the commandment is righteous. The Greek adjective dikaios denotes that which is in accord with the standards of what is right. 21, in the Greek and Roman tradition, the dikaios person was one who upheld the customs and norms of behavior that made for a well-ordered and civilized society. And so when you talk about righteousness, you have to deal with it in two things. You have to deal with righteousness in terms of the vertical, your relationship to God. God expects you to be in compliance with what's right. But then righteousness also has a horizontal component to it where you have to deal with your fellow man. And you are expected to demonstrate righteousness there. Well, all of this, all that righteousness that's there, flows out of God's natural law. This is how he's organized things. And humans can live up to it if they choose to. But again, the reality is it's got to come from the inside out. You can't force this on people. You can't make them righteous. Either they choose to be or they choose not to be. It's up to them. So 22, when Paul says the commandment is righteous, he is emphasizing that it conforms to the standards of God and promotes those standards among men. The law is fair and does not make unreasonable demands on men. See, that's another whole issue. Some might argue, well, the law is unreasonable. It's unreasonable to expect me to be perfect. Well, it is unreasonable because of the sin nature. And again, what we're going to find out is the sin nature is the root of all of this. This I'm finding out something as I'm going through Romans. I mean, I knew, I guess, at some level, but it's becoming increasingly clear that the sin nature is the issue. And Romans 6, 7, and 8 all deal with this matter of the flesh and the sin nature. Not your personal sins. But the personal sins and the sin nature were dealt with at the cross. However, we've got the residual sin nature still here that we have to deal with. Now, we know where we're headed. We're headed from here, salvation, to a point where there is not going to be an old sin nature. It's going to be gone. No old sin nature. You won't have one. That's where we're headed. Now, the goal for adjusted believers is not to live under its power now. And that power was broken at the cross. So, we don't have to. But guess what? We darn sure choose to, don't we? And that's the reality of it. And you have to kind of come to grips with that and say, well, yes, I do. I do fail. I do. And if you look ahead in chapter 8, I believe it's somewhere around verse 13, 12, actually, is what we're looking at. Because of all this work that was done on the cross, he concludes in verse 12, we are under obligation. See, phase two, Christianity, you better tell people, you say you believe in Jesus Christ, there are phase two issues here you better know about and you better address. Because you have obligations as a believer. We are under obligation not to the flesh, to live according to the flesh. For if you live according to the flesh, you must die. And we'll get into what all that means and why he's saying it. But the big thing here is, we no longer are bound by this. We're no longer controlled, don't have to be at any rate, by the old sin nature. We can live a different kind of life where it doesn't dominate our lives and our existence. Doesn't mean you're not going to fail under it. You will. But you know, and I hate to say this, but I do say it advisedly, you just have to learn to live with your own failure sometimes. And that's just the reality. Otherwise, you'll drive yourself nuts. What are you going to do someday? I'm going to be perfect. Well, the people that try to be perfect, guess what? They inevitably crack under the strain of it. You can't. So you have to, at a certain level, recognize, okay, I'm going to fail under the sin nature, but I don't have to like it. See, the people that fail under the sin nature and it doesn't bother them, that really throws a big, huge question mark over what they really are. They may be believers. I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying it throws a question mark over it. My normative experience has been, and I think it's very much Paul's here, is that even though all this is true, one of the things you can really tell in all of this is that Paul hates this. Now that becomes very clear if you look ahead again in chapter 7 to the end, when he describes himself. Wretched man, verse 24, wretched man that I am. This is not the cry of somebody who's not agonizing. This is not the cry of somebody who takes this lightly. This is a cry from the depths of despair at some level. But he doesn't despair. That's the whole thing. He goes back to thanks be with God. Thanks be to God. Who's going to set me free from this body of death? The old sin nature. Who's going to set me free from it? Well, it's done through Jesus Christ our Lord. We've been positionally set free from it. Now, we know that experientially we will be set free from it. And in phase two, the real issue is we don't have to live under it. Now, we can, but we don't have to. And those that do, well, they're going to have to deal with God. First, they're going to have to deal with matters of discipline that the adjusted believer doesn't deal with. God constantly frustrating them, jamming them, messing with their finances, messing with their details, messing with everything, messing with their jobs, messing with their heads. And for the believer who doesn't pursue God's will, well, God's got ways to get his attention. And if he's positive, I presume he will. But then again, some people out there, I don't think they're very positive to start with. So what God may leave them well enough alone at some level. Well, again, the idea here is that the righteous man, This all conforms to God's standards. And the law doesn't ask unreasonable things of men. It just says, love the Lord your God and love your neighbor. Are those unreasonable requests? They're really not. Why would you not love the God who created you? What's wrong with you? And why would you not love your fellow man? What reason do you have, really, against him? I mean, what could the fellow man have done to you? And for most of us, I don't know about you, but for most part, my life has been one where my fellow man has generally not done me too terribly wrong. I'm not saying they can't, or that they haven't on occasion, But generally speaking, and I presume it has to do with my orientation at some level to the truth, is that God protects me from a bunch of that. But if you keep your niche simple, like I've said from day one, keep it simple, stupid, and you line out with these principles as you go, God can grease your skids and make this a whole lot easier. Or He can drag you through it backwards, through a keyhole, if that's what you want. And He'll do either one. He doesn't care. I mean, He cares, but in a sense, he can't care. He has to do what's righteous and what's just. So He overrules how He feels about it and does the right thing, which is what we're supposed to do, of course. Well, 23, since the law only demands that which is fair, right, and just, it is proper for it to command men to abstain from that which is not in accordance with these standards. And these standards are what would lead you to life. This is what life is all about. Life is found in obedience to God. Life isn't found elsewhere. People live, but again, they're just existing. They're just going through the motions in many ways. And in many ways, many of them are just miserable creatures who really don't have any joy or experience of life to speak of. They just get miserable under their sin nature and they continue to grow. And that's what happens. That the longer this goes on, there's a cumulative effect. You can be pretty evil and stupid when you're young and you can get away with it. At a certain level, I mean, assuming God doesn't jam you up, He does, or He can, He will, He might. But the longer you keep up with this, the more you become entrenched in it, and the worse it's going to get. This is what people do not see. That this is only going to get worse. Solomon talks about the evil days of old age, and he describes sort of the physical breakdown of the body. But there's more to the evil days than just the breakdown of the body. There are people who are miserable and wretched and who refused God all their lives, and now He's turning His back on them. And their old age isn't fun. It isn't pleasant. It's misery and drudgery. I would prefer, an ideal world, I'd like to live right up to my last productive day and then just have God take me out in a day or two. That'd be it. I'd prefer not to die a long, protracted illness, but that's in God's hands. I'd rather not, I guess if you're going to get, dismembered in a car accident, that's pretty quick. Just have him take, you don't want to be like that guy on Grey's Anatomy Thursday. If you watch that, trapped in the car there for a long time. Well, that wasn't fun. So again, it's proper to command men to tell them, okay, avoid this. This is in your best interest to avoid these things. But see, that's how stupid we are under the sin nature. We don't see that God's acting in our own best interest. We think otherwise. We think we know better. And I say we, I'm using the editorial we. It doesn't mean that we always do this, but generally speaking, that's the way the human race is. They think they know better than God. They're sure they do, in fact. Well, 24, the final assertion Paul makes about the commandment is that it is good. The Greek adjective agathos is one of the two Greek terms that are translated good. And 25, while there is considerable debate as to the distinction between kalos, good, and agathos, good, the former focuses on that which is good from the standpoint of being pleasing, attractive, useful, or beneficial. It really deals with that which is a good example of what it should be. Like a good apple. A good apple doesn't have any worms in it. Bad apple? Yeah, not so much. Could have some worms in it. So again, good fruit, bad fruit. It doesn't mean the fruit's moral. One apple's better than the other, morally. Apples are just apples. They're inanimate objects. So, 27 here. 26, sorry, I'm sorry. That while there can be some similarities with the adjective kalos, the adjective agathos focuses more on that which is morally good. That which is consistent with the moral nature of God. And 27, while the commandment deals with the moral matter of what God expects, it is also true that the commandment was to have a beneficial effect on mankind. See, the problem, again, isn't with the commandment. It isn't with the God who gave it. It's with the sin nature. I mean, we're going to pound on this to where when you get through all this, you're going to be thinking, well, I've got more out of that than I wanted to know. I sure understand now. I see pretty clearly that it's not the law. It's not God. It's the sin nature. This is the source of the problems. And this is where He's headed. We've got to deal with the sin nature. And He did in Christ, obviously, at the cross. Retroactive positional truth. So again, the commandment was to have a beneficial effect on mankind. It was to result in life. Again, this presupposes a person could obey all of them, which, because of the sin nature, they can't. That's the problem. The sin nature is once again the culprit. No matter how you look at this, as a believer, you better understand it's your old sin nature that's at view here. And that is the focus of all of this. Well, 28, Paul will continue in verse 13 to use the neuter form of this adjective to represent the totality of what he has said about the law. Philippi suggests that the term is used because it represents the common essential root idea of the three adjectives in verse 12. When you look ahead, which we will get to on Tuesday, did that which is good, and he's talking about the law, become a cause of death for me? Did the law do this? No, the law didn't do it. But the law, as it were, was used by the sin nature to do it. The law essentially was a tool. Again, the word he uses there is a base of operations, an opportunity. So 29, he goes on to note that sin appears more sinful as a perversion and abuse of what is morally good than as a perversion and abuse of that which is merely useful. And that's true. That's a very good point, I thought. Because it's one thing to, you know, somebody gives you a gift and it's beneficial and you can use it. That's good. But if they do something really good for you, I mean morally good for you, and then you abuse that, that's different. That really is more heinous in a sense. That you would abuse that which is morally correct and substitute something else. Well, 30, with this statement about the Mosaic Law and the 10th commandment, which, by the way, again, while he focuses on the 10th, this is true of all the other commandments. I'm not saying it's not. I just think that his focus here was on the 10th commandment specifically. Paul puts to rest any idea that the law of God is to be blamed for the reality of sin, which uses the law to further its nefarious, that means wrong or wicked, ends and death. That's what the law does. It's used by the sin nature to kill. So, again, like anything in the world we talk about, things are neutral. Things are morally neutral in some way. Now, God's law is not morally neutral. God's law is actually positively good. Whereas we talk about things like guns, knives, baseball bats. Well, you can use a baseball bat to bludgeon somebody's head in, or you can use a baseball bat to play baseball. In one case, the bat's fine. In another case, it's been hijacked to do evil. Same thing's true with guns. Guns themselves don't buy into the stupidity out here in the world. Guns are evil. We got to get rid of all guns. You know, they're not evil. It's what people do with them. You can use a gun to sustain life. You can go out and kill a whatever. You got to be careful. You can't kill anything anymore. They're all endangered. We can't kill alligators because there's not enough of those. You know, they protect the stupidest stuff. I mean, these are... Anyway, don't get me off on that. We're done. So we'll pick up here Tuesday. Tuesday only this week, and then we'll take a break. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for our time together. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.